everyone. My name is Belinda Granger, and I'm the professional liaison for Challenge Family. I'm also known throughout the triathlon world as being a bit of a mother hen to the pro athletes. Of course, given the current circumstances, I've been thinking about the athletes a lot lately. So we came up with the idea of Coffee Calls with Belinda, which basically gives me and you an opportunity to check in with them all and see how they're all going. So welcome to the official Challenge Family podcast. I think it's time for a coffee. And welcome back to Coffee Calls with Belinda. My name is Belinda Granger, and I have a very special and very interesting guest today. I have been wanting to talk to this young man for a long time now, but he's a very difficult man to catch up with because he is always away doing cool and crazy things with other athletes. Welcome to the call, Ascot. You can drop.
Hi, Belinda. Nice to meet you.
It's lovely. Now, I know we actually have met before many years ago in Kona when we've been on power bar panels before, but that almost seems like a lifetime ago for me. But yes, you have been in the sport of involved in the sport of triathlon for a long, long time now, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's correct, and definitely have a passion for the sport.
Obviously, triathlon is not the only sport that you're involved with. You are an absolute nutritional specialist, gosh, I can't get my words out, in many sports, and you work with many different elite athletes around the world.
Yes, it's I started off very differently. I started off as an athlete, got interested, then studied sort of sports science or exercise physiology, then became more and more interested in nutrition, but spent a lot of time sort of in academia at universities doing research and teaching, but also always tried to make the link to the real world and see how we could use the research and all that knowledge to help athletes. So over time, I've drifted more and more towards helping athletes or helping teams and organization improving their performance, mostly through nutrition. So, and in that role, I've worked with many athletes in many different sports, and it's really interesting work as well, because the whole cultures around eating and nutrition in different sports are very, very different. So it's been a great journey.
Oh, I can only imagine. And speaking of sports, so you were an avid, obviously you've been an avid sports person your whole life. You grew up firstly playing football or soccer, is that correct? Before you then got into cycling and then got obviously hooked into triathlon, duathlon. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So I grew up in Holland, and like every kid
of
in
course.
Holland grows up with...
to be a cyclist, yes.
Yeah, so started cycling and running really, really early. I did a triathlon really early as well, one of the first triathlons in Europe. So this
wow.
is like a very long time ago. And that was like a quarter distance at the time. So not quite Olympic, but better for me because the swim was a bit shorter.
Good. That's always a good thing.
Yeah. And then I didn't do triathlon for many years, and then I did an Ironman by accident.
So, no way! And what one was that?
It was a race called Umbrenman in France. So very hard race in the Alps, made for cyclists. So
I cannot believe that was your very first time in. Long distance or, you know, full distance racing, because I know Umbrenman quite well. My husband has done it, and obviously it's been all over social media lately because it was supposed to be going ahead this year, but unfortunately they've had to cancel it, which is really, really disappointing, and I know devastating for the long time owner. He's an amazing man himself, but that's actually even longer than the traditional Ironman distance, because I know you get back to transition at about 180, and then you've got another 10K to do, which is a 5K climb, 5K up and 5K down. Is that right?
Exactly. Oh. Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, wow. It's a tough, tough race, but absolutely beautiful race. And the reason that I did that one was, and the reason it was by accident, was that I was there with a friend who is a good triathlete. And he asked me to come to France to train with him and as a cyclist. So I was a cyclist. I didn't do any running or swimming.
Right.
So we trained for a few weeks in preparation for this event for him. And I did a tiny little bit of running with him as well, and a tiny little bit of swimming. And then he got injured in the week before the race. So he couldn't do the race, and he said, why don't you do it? And just take my number, which was...
Oh my gosh, that's crazy.
What was a number on the first line, so it was a single digit number. And so I pinned on that number, and that's how I did my first race.
That's madness. I tell you what, ignorance is bliss sometimes, isn't it? When you don't know what you're getting, when you don't know what you're getting yourself in for. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. And obviously since then, you've raced Kona, so the Ironman World Championships, 6 times. Yep. And I did see that you've also run 3 of the marathon majors, so Boston, Berlin, and New York. So you've done quite a lot of the cool events, I like to call them, cool events around the world, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I just had an opportunity to do a lot of great races around the world and get that experience, and it's great. And I don't compete at the very highest level, but for me it's about like getting everything right on the day, making sure that you get your nutrition right, you don't make any major mistakes, and that's difficult enough.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's still professional athletes that, you know, obviously do it for a living that are still trying to get that part right. So it's something I think you're forever working on, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Asker, you obviously grew up in the Netherlands. You are Dutch, but you moved to the... When did you... I know you moved to the UK, and that's where you are based now in the UK. But what age were you when you actually moved across? And did you move across for study? Is that the reason originally?
No, I finished my studies in Holland, did my PhD in Holland.
Right.
Then I moved over to the US for a little while, lived in Texas for a while. And then I took a position at the University of Birmingham.
Okay.
And I think I was around 30 years old when I moved here.
Wow.
And just started a position at the university and built up a lab in a sports science department, a human performance lab. And then gradually grew in that role, and we had a really successful research team, and that got bigger and bigger. And so something that I'm very proud of what we achieved with that team. Yeah.
And are you still based there now, or you've moved on since then, or?
So I've moved on from the university.
Yeah.
So that was in 2011, and I worked in industry for a little while, just doing something like quite different. At the university, it's a great place to do research and a great place for teaching. But I was trying to make sure that the research also landed with the athletes. And I found being in academia actually a really difficult place to do that. So I tried something different. I worked in industry for a while with a large sports nutrition company with Gatorade. I was head of the Gatorade Sports Science Institute for a while, because in that role you have the opportunity to reach a lot more people, and if you change the product, then you immediately influence things. So I did that for a while, and then decided in 2014 to really start for myself as a consultant, and now I just work with individual athletes, but mostly with teams or organizations to help with sports science and sports nutrition in particular.
Okay, so I obviously, when I first met you, you were heavily involved consulting with Powerbar, And of course, they were one of my longest standing sponsors. And I think that's how you originally got the connection with Zibby from Challenge Family as well.
Yep.
So how long were you working together with Powerbar?
For many years. What happened was that we developed in at the University of Birmingham, we developed a formula which was a combination of different carbohydrates that was faster absorbed, that provided more energy during prolonged activity. We found that you can actually get up to 75% more carbohydrate with this particular mixture of carbohydrates into the body. But none of the sort of sports nutrition brands seem to take notice of this this research. One of my frustrations, you do the research and then no one actually uses it. And Powerbar was sort of the first to step in and made all of their products with that sort of blend or ratio of carbohydrates. And that this is where I got involved more with Powerbar. So the research came first and then Powerbar incorporated it, and they've really tried to improve their products using that technology and using science in general. So
that's fascinating.
Yeah, and then like one of the it wasn't just about the products. We did a lot of what I did with Zibby at the time was organize conferences to educate people more in the sports nutrition area.
Yeah.
And those were series of very successful conferences.
Yeah, that's it's interesting you say that, because I when I knew that I was going to be talking to you, I thought back to when I very first started racing as a professional athlete, which was right at the end of the very late 90s, early 2000s. And there really wasn't that much known about sports nutrition, specific sports nutrition. And over the years, I mean, I was an athlete for quite a long time, just to see how far it has come from when I first remember doing my very first full distance event in, I think, 1999, where I think I remember taking Vegemite sandwiches on the bike to where we are today. And far out, it has come a long way. And I even think about my mindset when it comes to nutrition back then was I didn't even think of it as being a major piece of the puzzle. Whereas now, being a lot older and wiser, it is one of the main pieces of the puzzle. And I think a lot of athletes now, and not just professional athletes, but age group athletes alike, spend a lot more time and effort thinking about their nutrition plan, particularly during a race, than what they did back in my day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think this is actually a trend that will continue, because I think people will more and more start to realize how important nutrition really is. Like everyone understands that training is important.
Yes,
and you don't need to convince anyone that is important. But actually what training is, just making the body tired, and then you get better in the recovery phase, of course, where nutrition is the key factor, really. That determines how you rebuild and what you rebuild and how fast you rebuild. And that's so it's absolutely key in training, and of course also in racing, which has been like over the last few years mostly the focus, right? People start to think about nutrition like a few days before the race starts.
It's not really going to cut the mustard, though, is it? Like, you don't, if you're only thinking about your nutrition plan a few days out, what's your ideal? I mean, a nutrition plan should be something that you're working on 24/7 for the entire year.
I always compare it to sort of building a castle, I say. So you imagine you're just building a castle, maybe not from the ground up, but you really have to. It's going to take a lot of time before you build that thing. It's a big project. So every day you have to sort of lay the bricks, and you have to lay the bricks carefully. And if you have some days where maybe the bricks aren't perfect, it's not a problem, of course, for the the castle, but if you have many days where you use bad bricks to build your castle, then that's going to have an effect on the overall quality of the castle. So it is important. It is about consistency and doing things consistently right. Just with training, no one questions this, right?
Everyone
knows that you need to train. You need to train regularly. You need to train well, not just like being out there and doing something. You need to train well. Quality is important. And with nutrition, it's really not that different. It is about the consistency, keeping doing things right day after day after day. And occasionally, of course, it's okay to let some steam off. And
of course,
that's absolutely no problem. But the more days of the year you've done things right, the better the end product will be.
Yeah, and then I think, you know, obviously as well, if you can get into a good routine, then you don't start with these bad habits. Like I was telling you before, since we were in lockdown, and then obviously I was looking for excuses to open a bottle of wine every night, and it got to a stage where that became a bad habit. And I think if you don't practice good habits routinely, bad habits creep in before you know it. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you think, oh, I'm having a glass of wine every night. This is not right. So it is very difficult to break a bad habit once it becomes normality.
Yeah, no, this is absolutely, absolutely key, I think. And this is also why I think education from early age is so important, because it's really difficult for anyone to change habits in general. Yeah. And nutrition habits seem to be particularly strong and difficult to change. So if you have the right habits from day one, then gosh, you make your life so much easier.
Yes, exactly. And you know, it's interesting because obviously where I'm based here in Noosa, Queensland, we have so many pro athletes. I'm surrounded by professional triathletes all the time. And because I get to sit back and observe now, it's very, very interesting to see, and I don't criticize, I just like to observe the eating habits of these professional athletes, and they differ so significantly, which I find fascinating, because you would think, okay, they're all professional athletes, they're all very, very good at their craft, but each and every one of them is so completely different in their eating habits, almost to the extent where it blows me away, because it's not like, okay, they're sort of the same, but this person's a little gluten intolerant, so they can't eat a certain thing. You know, we were talking before we started tonight about, I can't believe you've got these, some athletes on the low-carb, high-fat diet or high-protein carnivore diet. Then you've got your plant-based athletes now, your athletes that refuse to eat any sort of gluten, even though they may not have a gluten intolerance per se. And then my favorite, which I just learned about a month ago, the flexitarians, which is what I've been told is semi-vegetarian, but basically a little bit of everything. What's your take on that? Why are athletes, and I'm going to say professional athletes, because that's the people I've been looking at right now. I'm sure it is all athletes, all like age group athletes alike. Why are they going for these? I don't like to use the word extreme, but they're these extreme diets. Growing up for me, it was everything in moderation. That was the diet that I lived by, and I still do to this day. But athletes don't seem to live by that motto anymore. They like to go for these extreme diets where it's either one way or the other.
Yeah, it's I don't know exactly why we sort of we tend to make things so extreme, but
difficult. Yeah,
it's partly if you are changing your habits, if you are changing your diet, it's sometimes easier to stick to a few very simple rules. And that's what most of these diets do. They just introduce a few simple, simplified and actually oversimplified rules where you can't eat this and you can't eat that. Because that's what usually what diets are about. They tell you what not to eat.
To eat, yes,
They don't tell you what to eat. They tell you what not to eat because it's much easier. You just avoid this and that. And when you do that, you automatically put foods into categories of good and bad. And that has to do a lot with how our brain works. I always, like, this is an oversimplification as well, but our brain essentially has two parts to it. One is sort of the ancient part that was all about survival. It is a part that is super strong, is very quick in making decisions. And it does so by making things very black and white. Something is dangerous or it's not. Something is good or it's bad. And the other part of our brain is sort of the reflective part. That's the part that got us to the moon. That's where we analyze things and we put things into context. And that part of the brain we use quite a lot, but it is very, very slow compared to, and also not as powerful as the sort of the ancient part of the brain. And I think in the world that we live in, we are bombarded with so much information on a daily basis, like even just scrolling through Instagram, for example, within a few seconds, you go through numerous messages and your brain is like half interpreting these messages. And you scroll through Instagram and like within split seconds, you have to decide this is good information, this is bad information, this is what I want to read a little bit more. And so that part can only work with the sort of the instinctive ancient brain. That's the only part that is fast enough to deal with that sort of information. And we can only deal with it if we think in black and white. And I think this has a lot to do with why we think the way we think, because simply the overload of information that we get, and we don't have time to really reflect on things, put things into context. And I think that has something to do with it, at least.
Wow, I didn't even think of looking at this from my brain's perspective, but you're so right. I mean, we could even take into, for example, with COVID, et cetera, at this moment, and making decisions on what's right and wrong there. I think about how much information I'm being inundated with at the moment with this virus. And you're right. You scroll through social media every day and I'm being bombarded by this is what we should be doing, this is what we shouldn't be doing, and trying to make decisions. And it's virtually impossible. And I have found that's been the hardest thing for me during this time, is to try and work out what's the correct information and what isn't. And it's the same with nutrition and with what I think is good for me and what I think is bad. And then should I really be putting things in the good and bad categories? Is that even correct itself? Is there something that's always bad and something that's always good?
Yeah, no, I think my answer would be very clearly no, it's not, because it depends. It depends is the answer. That's actually the answer that the scientist gives to everything. It depends.
It depends.
But it is important because it depends on what your goals are, what is good and bad. And I think in general also, there are no good and bad foods. There are good and bad sort of diets, how you put all those foods together.
Right.
But whether a food is bad or good depends also on the quantities that we eat.
And so, what about when it comes to, because obviously one of the big ones that I've seen a significant amount of, particularly professional athletes, is the low carb, high fat, which is completely against everything I was taught growing up. And of course, this is a long time ago, where we were the other way. It was all about the carbs and just small amounts of fat and protein, particularly to get through the endurance events. Obviously, this has changed over the years as more research has been done. But what's your take on low carb, high fat? And let's be specific, for endurance athletes here.
Let me start with asking you a question. So would you do interval training every day?
No. Well, actually, no. Back when I was racing, no, I didn't. These days, because I've got such limited time, yes, every session's just crazy, but that's because that's different because, you know, I've got a set amount of time to do it. But no, as a professional triathlete, no, I wouldn't do interval training every day.
So, and I think there is a little bit of a parallel here with diet, because would you have low carb every day? I don't think that is a good idea for numerous of reasons that I'll go into in a minute. Would I do low or high carb every day? I probably wouldn't for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is if you eat a high carb diet every day, then every day you're going to suppress your fat metabolism and you will not allow it to develop as much as it really could.
Right.
On the other hand, if you are on a low carb diet, you let your fat metabolism develop really well, but now you're not developing your carbohydrate metabolism.
Oh,
and that's
okay.
What you really need, especially when the intensity gets a little bit higher. So why would we just train one part of our metabolism, one part of our system? And why would we not train on certain days? We would train with high carb, have really high quality sessions where we train our carbohydrate metabolism. We also train, by doing that, we train our gut. We train ourselves to tolerate carbohydrate intake during exercise. And this is what you see with people who avoid carbohydrate for whatever reason, whether it's because they think it makes them fat or
fat,
because they're on a low carb diet. Those are the athletes usually that when it comes to race time, they think, oh yeah, I do need some gels, and then they can't tolerate them because their gut hasn't been trained and it's not used to it. So I would never just stick to like one particular diet that is always low in one nutrient or always high in one particular nutrient. I would mix it up depending on the goal of the day. So on some days you may want to train your fat metabolism, then be clever when you eat your carbohydrate or maybe reduce carbohydrate intake. On other days, you may want a very high quality session, or you may want to train your gut. That is a day where you use very high carbohydrate intake. So it just mix it up.
Right. So it goes, I remember, I'm sure you remember the pro triathlete Laura Bennett, who was predominantly an Olympic distance athlete, but did do a few long course races towards the end of her career. And she said the biggest mistake that an athlete makes is that they train to eat, they don't eat to train. And it's something that I've kept ever since she told me all those years ago, and it's probably about 15 years ago that she first told me that. And it makes so much sense because so many times I hear athletes say, oh, I've got a 6-hour ride today and I'm gonna save it up so that when I get to we have a famous bakery here called the Kenilworth Bakery, and they do the most amazing donuts. I'm going to save it up and I'm not going to eat a thing till I get to the Kenilworth Bakery, and then I'm going to scoff down two donuts. And I'm like, you guys have got it all wrong. That is not the way that you should be. You should be fueling your body so that you can, train. But they are doing it the other way around, and they're training their body. They're training so that they can get to the other end and eat. And it's just the completely wrong way to do it.
Yeah, it depends. Every training should start with, like, what is the purpose of today? So that should be the first question. And then in order to achieve that, what is the best training that I can do? And how can I structure my eating to support that? That's the thought process that should go into every day of training. I work in professional cycling as well. That's where we have really dialed this in now with the team that I work with. We use software to help the riders make the right decisions, and not only on what to eat, but also exactly how much. So it's becoming definitely eating is becoming a science in some parts.
And that's, I mean, obviously when you talk about cyclists where they have to back up day after day after day, I mean, to me, nutrition is absolutely crucial. And as you said, not just what to eat, the amount, but also when. I mean, when is the crucial, particularly when they get to the end of the day. And I know myself, when I've done a long day of training or racing, you don't always make the wisest decisions because your brain isn't operating correctly. So I know with the cycling teams, it must be so fantastic for them to have someone like you who can actually make those decisions for them.
Yeah, and the initial response also with the cyclist is like, oh, I'm not sure, because it goes against what I'm used to, or it goes against what my body tells me. And so initially there was definitely sort of a little bit of a reluctance, and but pretty quickly it became clear that if they were eating just based on some of the measurements that that we've done, they didn't have any bad days anymore.
Wow.
And this is partly because I think eating to how you feel is great to an extent, because it works in many situations, but in, like, especially if you talk Tour de France or races like that, then your feelings are really out of sync with your needs. Not in the first week maybe, but in the second week when you start to get really, really tired. And certainly in the third week where you're really tired and your GI tract doesn't work very well anymore. Sometimes you just have to, like, the riders at least have to trust the system. And now, like, after a couple of years of experience with this, they really believe in this system.
Oh, I can only imagine. I just think back to when I was on training camps in the mountains, and the first week there, you know, my nutrition was, you'd make great meals every night. You'd really spend a lot of time because you were fresh. And then the second week, things would start to slacken off. You'd start making some poor choices. By the third and fourth week of camp, you definitely, I remember myself, I definitely was not making wise choices. And when you're training 30 plus hours, I just think it's so easy to fall off, I like to say fall off the wagon. I look now where I'm not training to race. I train because I love training, and I love the feeling of being healthy and fit. But because I'm probably only training around 15 hours a week now, I never get myself to that stage of exhaustion, both physically and mentally. So I make wise decisions about my nutrition. So I see, as I go back to observing athletes now, I see them make poor choices. And those poor choices are, you know, lots of chocolate, eating lollies or, you know, candy on rides, drinking Coke like it's going out of fashion. And I just see, for me, I can look back and say, okay, these are all poor choices. But a lot of triathletes do not have, like these Tour de France riders, they don't have a support team around them to help them make these sensible decisions.
Yeah, that's the difficulty, I think, now for a lot of athletes, is like there is also so much information out there.
Yes, right?
So you don't immediately have the support, but you have access to enormous amounts of information, most of which is pretty bad information, to be honest.
Yeah.
And I would say 20% of what's written on nutrition is sensible information. And how do you differentiate the good stuff from the bad stuff? And that's where a lot of people go wrong, because we make, going back to how the brain works, we make decisions on sort of like very quick decisions on how things look and how things are presented, not necessarily on, like, we don't carefully evaluate the content. We look at, wow, this product looks amazing, and this and this article has such great illustrations. That's
so it's got to be good.
It's got to be good. Unfortunately, that's part of how we assess the quality of information.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then, you know, obviously, then adding in an exhausted body and an exhausted brain from training copious hours, you can see how poor decisions are easily made.
Yeah, and I should also say that sometimes, like, these poor decisions, we're not talking about like eating junk food, for example, but we're talking about people who are really, really believe that eating like what they think is healthy foods or what people generally think are healthy foods, it may not be the right time to eat them.
Yeah, yeah. And is that a really important, as far as you're concerned, when and what you actually eat throughout a training day?
Yeah, absolutely. It is very important to look at quantities that you eat, which depend very much on the goal of your training and also how much training you do, of course. But also the when you eat it is going to be really important. And the story there is a little bit different for carbohydrate than it is for protein, where with carbohydrate, you want the intake probably around the training sessions in most cases. With protein, you want it almost independently of your training, but you want it consistently throughout the day.
Okay.
And that's those are things, like with protein, for example, there's still the idea, I need the protein in the hour after exercise.
Yes, exactly. I was just about to bring that up. Is that still, I know when I used to do my big brick sessions, the most important thing was as soon as you finished that run, that you made yourself that protein shake that had to be taken before you went for a shower, before you did anything else, you had to get that protein shake down.
That's right. And I think that's not really how protein works. It is important to take protein after exercise because it's a really effective time to take it. But the effect of protein is not like the effect of carbohydrate. The effect of carbohydrate is pretty instant, like it works within like minutes or hours. The effect of protein is a really long-term effect. So if someone takes protein for recovery, that doesn't mean that you're going to feel better like 2, 3, 4 hours later or even the day after. Protein is really all those bricks that you build a castle with. So you're not going to build that castle very, very quickly in the hour after exercise, right? It's a long-term thing by making sure that you provide the right building blocks, the right amino acids in your proteins at very regular intervals. So the advice for protein, for example, is to take about 20-25 grams of protein every 3 to 4 hours. That's far more important than making sure that you have your protein shake
post-exercise.
But of course,
Belinda,
the protein shake post-exercise can, of course, be one of those moments.
Yes.
And that's how I would normally plan it. That's one of the more important moments. So make sure that you take your shake, you get your 20 to 25 grams immediately post-exercise, but also make sure that the other moments throughout the day, you do the same thing.
Of course, whereas I think a lot of people don't. I think, like you said, they think, okay, protein shake's done. That means I should be recovered by tomorrow and ready to go again. But that's simply not the case. No. And what's your take? And I mean, I'm asking you these questions now. I'm being so selfish because these are things I've been dying to ask you for quite some time. Where athletes are completely cutting out a particular nutrient. So, for example, a big thing over here at the moment is the carnivore diet. Not necessarily just with triathletes. We've had an article come up recently in one of our papers. There's quite a few elite athletes of different sports that have taken on the carnivore diet. So they've basically cut out vegetables, fruit and vegetables, and it's just meat. What's your take on that? I've never tried it. I don't think I could do it. I love fruit and vegetables too much to do it. But what would be the science behind that? And of course, the other way, we've got athletes that are just purely plant-based and they don't eat any protein or very little protein. and it seems to be something that athletes are thinking there's going to be a miracle there if they go either way.
Yeah, no, I don't think there are miracle diets. And I think any time you're going to exclude a food or a food group from your diet, that's actually quite risky. Yep. So if you're cutting out meat, well, you better know what you're doing and replace it with something else, because otherwise it could cause problems. Or if you're cutting out vegetables completely, well, to me, that would be very risky as well. We humans have evolved to eat whatever was available. Yeah. I think they haven't evolved as sort of meat eaters or plant eaters. They have evolved to eat whatever they could find. And that also means that we can probably get away with a lot because we're very adaptable. Right. So if we are in a situation where we can only eat meat, that's fine for quite some time. Or when we can only eat plants for some time, that's fine too. It's the deficiencies would develop over much longer periods of time.
Exactly.
But before we get to the deficiencies, there may we are not really looking for at nutrition to avoid deficiencies in sport. We are looking to really optimize everything to support our training, and that's definitely been sort of a different thinking in the last 20 years or so. Before that, nutrition was all about preventing deficiencies. The food labels on products, that's still all about preventing deficiencies. Mm. These are the amounts you need, because if you don't get them, you become deficient. Yeah. But that's, as athletes, that's not really what we're interested in. We're not interested in just the preventing a deficiency. We want to take nutrients in the amounts that is optimal to support our training.
Okay, yes.
And that's really why I think excluding foods is really not a great idea. And so we talk very often about the balanced diet, but that term, although I think it actually describes it quite well, it's very difficult for people to interpret what that actually means. Everyone talks about a balanced diet, but what is a balanced diet? And I think part of it is that you don't actually exclude foods or food groups from what you eat, and you eat things, as you said, in moderation. And sometimes you need more of certain foods to support a certain type of training, and other days you need less of certain foods because you just don't need
exactly. And what about the athlete themselves? Obviously, you work with an array of different athletes, even within a team. For example, I know you were just away with one of the Tour de France teams, and within that team, you would have athletes in that team that differ. Some work better with a higher protein, some work better with higher carbs. You might have some that have a certain level of gluten intolerance. I'm not sure, but I just know, do you work, obviously, you specifically work with that individual? It's not like a one size fits all.
No, it's definitely not a one size fits all. But having said that, I think it's important to realize that we all have a very similar physiology. Yes. And our DNA is for more than 99% the same. So in that respect, there are no, like, it's not that you would put one person on a low carb diet and another person on a high carb diet, and they would both have the perfect diet. It doesn't work that way. But there are individual differences, and like, clearly some people can tolerate more food than others. Also in races, for example, we all know people that just take one or two gels and they already get stomach problems.
Yes.
And then others who just eat these enormous amounts of food and have no problem.
That was me. back in the day, you know, obviously I trained with Chrissy Wellington for many years under Brett Sutton, and even on some of our longer track sessions, you know, I would come down to the track with five or six gels to get through a 30K track session. Whereas Chrissy, if she had have eaten the same amount that I would had eaten, she would be in the toilets for half that session, because obviously she was a lot different. And neither of us had any, we were fine with carbohydrates. We didn't have any intolerances. We could eat everything and anything. But like you said, her stomach just could not cope with the greater amounts of calories going in, whereas my body could. So it was quite interesting to see the difference there. And I know you did quite a lot of work with Chrissy back when she was racing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some of this, so the question then is, what you're describing here, is this genetic? Mm. Or is this because of just different food habits in general? And I think this one is much more related to sort of the food habits in general. So if people are sort of restricting their food intake and thinking really carefully about what they're eating all the time, making sure they're not eating too much, then that has disadvantages when it comes to these things. And you can't tolerate the larger amounts of gels, even though you probably would benefit from them if you could tolerate them.
Yeah. And you mean you see it every year when I used to go over and watch the Ironman World Championships in Kona. You would see it every year, those athletes that were just obviously fueling really well, the fuel was working the way it was supposed to work, and then the others that just could not tolerate anymore, you know, they'd have these big bellies sticking out where nothing was going in.
Yep.
And I think because of the extreme conditions of Kona, it was exacerbated, and you could see it clearly, the difference in an athlete that was just thriving from their nutrition plan on race day and those athletes that were struggling. And
absolutely. And I think this is also one of the big changes that I see happen now, that are finally starting to happen, that athletes are starting to incorporate what I call nutritional training into their
everyday
weekly
training
plan.
Yeah.
So they, and this is also what I would recommend. So if you have a race plan where you say, I take X number of gels, or that is the plan, then make sure at least once a week that you practice that plan. And don't just wait till race day and then use all these products, but practice the plan. Maybe even take more, because race day is always a little bit more nervous, is always a little bit more intense. Yeah. So it's harder to tolerate things on race day than it is on a training day. So we've also, in terms of recommendations, in the last few years, we've actually gone to higher carbohydrate intakes. And that makes it even more difficult if you're not used to it. So it's so important to practice this, and practice it with the same products that you're going to use in on race day.
And now that brings me to my next question for you. You obviously, with Core Nutrition Planning, you have a platform now whereby an athlete can actually go to this platform, and it actually takes care of, or it helps develop your race day fueling. So it's obviously not just for race day, but it's something that you develop 10 weeks out, and then into race day itself.
Yeah, that's correct. I think it doesn't need to be exactly 10 weeks before, but at least that number of weeks you need to really get your intestines, your gut, your stomach adjusted to the race day intake, really. So the reason we started to develop this platform is that I got so many questions from athletes always about, I didn't get my race nutrition right. And it's the number one reason by far.
Every time. I don't think I've ever been to a race where I haven't spoken to an athlete at the end who said, I don't know what happened out there, but I just couldn't take my race nutrition. I just didn't feel like eating. And I'm like, it's never about feeling like eating. I never felt like eating either, but I knew that if I didn't, that my race would suffer. So it's fascinating that you actually bring that up, because I agree with you. It's the number one, I don't like to say excuse, but the number one thing that an athlete says when they don't have a race that goes to plan. I got my nutrition wrong. Always.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, and I got a lot of questions from athletes. And then every time I sat down with an athlete, I'm asking the same questions. And depending on the answers they provided, I would then give them advice for the right. next race. And pretty, like, if you personalize the advice, it's pretty successful. But because the questions I was asking were always the same, and then my responses, depending on their answers, was always the same, I thought, well, why don't we make this more scalable? Yeah. And why don't I turn this into sort of an application that people can use to guide themselves to a better nutrition plan? And that's how this core nutrition planning, or fuelthecore.com is the website. That's how it was born. So the whole idea with this platform is that you can go in, you can try this for free, by the way. And in sort of five simple steps, we get you to a nutrition plan. It doesn't take long at all. 5 minutes, you have a really good nutrition plan. And the first step is really... it asks a few questions about you to get to know you as an athlete.
Yep. So,
of course, nutrition advice for a pro is different than for sort of a first timer, or for someone who does longer distance, it's different for shorter distance.
Yep.
It also asks a little bit about like your physiology. Some people sweat more than others. We all know people who hardly ever seem to sweat, and then other people
dripping.
produce a lake in a matter of
exactly.
minutes.
Exactly.
So, and part of this is genetic. Part of this is depending on weather. Part of this is depending on the exercise intensity. And the software works this out. It sort of calculates sweat rate based on a number of inputs. One of the inputs, for example, is weather, which the application downloads for the race that you're going to do. So the first part of the course is really about the athlete. The second part is about what is the event that you're going to do and how fast are you going to do it. And also a really important question that you'll get in there is, like, what is your goal? Mm. Because the nutrition advice for someone who wants to run a personal best is very different for someone who just wants to make
finish
it to
line.
The finish
yeah.
line.
Yeah.
And someone who had stomach problems in the last event, but now just wants to make it to the finish without stomach problems, would get different advice again. So those are like important questions to ask. And then the next step takes you to, what are the fuels that you want to use? Are you going to use the fuels that are available on course and those products? Do you have your own sort of brand that you want to work with that works really well for you? So that's dialing the fuels is the next part. And then after those three steps, it already gives you a plan, and it tells you exactly what to take when. And all of that is just simply based on science, on all the things that we know. It calculates your sweat rate. It allows for a certain sweat loss at the finish, not too little, not too much. It calculates your carbohydrate needs, which are also dependent on how much you can tolerate. So we get an idea of how much you can tolerate, and all of that together gives you a plan that so far we haven't had anyone come back to us and say this plan
didn't work for me. Wow.
Yeah. And so all the software does is it's sort of it makes it evidence based. Mm-hmm. It's led by science, but it takes away all the extremes that people do. Like, it takes away, like, taking far too many gels. Or far too few, or drinking
too
far
much
too
or
little.
Too yeah yeah
yeah or too yeah Yeah, so it's taken away the definitely the extremes, and it just personalizes it as well. By so if I ask people questions about what does your carbohydrate intake look like in your diet, but also in training, do you train with carbohydrates or not? Those are really important questions to understand what the tolerance of the gut would be. So I think that's it's a tool now that's out there for people to try. As I said, there's a free version that you can just get some idea, and there is a premium version where you pay for the software where you can personalize things a little bit more, and you can have the exact distance of your training, for example, because I talk about it as a race thing now, but it's you can also use it for training,
which would be so important. I mean, I think about all the athletes I know, whether they be professional athletes or age group, they invest so much time in the actual training, only to stuff it up on race day because they've missed out on the crucial key of nutrition.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think we also have to think much more about nutrition as like something that is 24/7, as we said at the beginning, and much less, oh, it's just about race day. I walk around at the expo, I buy gels.
Honestly, but you've hit the nail on the head there. The amount of times I've had friends that I'm just going to go and buy my race day nutrition. I said, oh, what are you getting? Oh, I don't know. I'll have a look and see if there's something on sale or see what I'm like, so you're going to use something that you've never used before, but, you know, that's going to be okay for race day. It blows my mind because these are normally people that have a coach. So spend money with having a coach and having a rigid training program that they've stuck to like glue for months on end, and then, as I just said before, they're going to blow it all to smithereens by going and choosing a product that they've never used before. And this, again, I go back to Ironman World Championships, and this is where they seem to get suckered in, because they walk through that expo and they're bamboozled with so many amazing products. And then they see, you know, certain pro athletes taking this product and it works for them, so surely it's going to work for me too. And it just... And again, I only can see it now that I'm a little older and wiser, and it blows my mind that this continues to be something that happens year in and year out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the three main mistakes I think that people make. So is like the day before, sort of change your or buy new products and try something new. And so that's one mistake. The second mistake is that people just go into the race without really having a plan and say, oh, I'll see how I feel.
I'll eat when I feel like it. That's right. Which is never.
Yeah. And then, and the third mistake is that people actually have a plan. They have thought about it very carefully, and then they stick to it on race day at all cost. And that's, I think you also have to, at some point you've got to be sensible, right? Yep. So you may have a plan, and for most athletes, even professional athletes, at some point the plan goes out of the window. And
I agree.
And hopefully this happens just a few kilometers from the finish and not halfway through the race.
Yep.
But at some point you need to be sensible and say, okay, it's probably good to maybe skip a gel now and just have slightly lower overall carbohydrate intake, and not just keep forcing it down if you know that you're actually not going to be able to tolerate it.
That's right. And with this platform, obviously you've done the research, you've done the studies, it's science based. But can I ask you, and a friend of mine bought this when I told her that I was going to be talking to you. She also studies nutrition and she loves it, and she was very excited. But a lot of the studies that have been done are predominantly have been done with males, particularly when you come to low carb, high fat. But how does it differ for women? Because obviously males versus females, and we haven't spoken about that yet, but, you know, obviously there are genetic differences between males and females. So does the race day fueling or fuel the core, does it is it based on, do you have differences within the program on the platform to help with that?
Yeah, so if, of course, if there were reasons to build in these differences, we would have built in the differences.
Okay, yep.
But the science isn't actually there to say that that's necessary.
Okay.
So I agree with you that the vast majority of studies is all on male on male subjects, and we really need more studies in females. But we did actually do some studies that are really relevant to race day fueling, where we compared males and females, and we did that on numerous occasions. And we tried to match males and females as well as we could. And the conclusions were that really there was no reason to change the recommendations in terms of carbohydrate intake.
Wow.
Yeah. So, like what, for example, if you take a drink that is like all glucose,
yes,
and you give that to male and female athletes, it seems that the maximum amount that you can use from that drink is about 60 grams per hour. And that's the same in males and females. There's really no difference. So if you, you would then say, well, but generally sort of female athletes are lighter. Shouldn't this be expressed per kilogram body weight? And the answer is no, because when we looked at the relationship between body weight and how much carbohydrate you can use, there really is no correlation whatsoever.
Oh, wow.
And maybe that's a little bit counterintuitive,
yep,
but that's a fact. So because we couldn't find any reasons to change the recommendations for women, that's why the platform doesn't even ask the question whether you're
male or female.
A man or a
okay.
woman.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what about if we're looking at athletes, and I'm going to bring some specific names into the equation. For example, if we pick three athletes, Sebastian Kienle, Lionel Sanders, and Jan Frodeno. You've got Sebastian Kienle and Lionel Sanders, who are your thicker. I mean, all athletes would have very low percentage fat, obviously. But you've got someone like Jan Frodeno, who's tall and very, very thin. I don't even know what his body fat percentage would be, but it would be probably something ridiculous. And then you've got a musclier, so a much bigger muscle mass athlete when you look at someone like Lionel Sanders and Sebi Kinley. Would their nutrition plan obviously differ greatly because of their physique, or again, not necessarily?
Yeah, not necessarily. Yeah. Because most of what it would depend on their power outputs. So if we compare the bikes, for example, then the power output on the bike probably isn't hugely different, and therefore the nutritional requirements are probably not going to be
different.
Different, even though their physiques
look quite different.
Yeah. What matters is, in this case, is the function of the GI tract.
Okay.
How much carbohydrate can the GI tract supply? And that doesn't really seem to be different between individuals. So I mentioned this 60 grams per hour that you can take up from glucose. And that really seems to be very different. Really independent of body shape, body size, man, women, it seems to be like fairly set in stone. Maybe like there are small individual differences, but they're really negligible,
right,
in terms of giving advice.
Wow.
And then the interesting thing is we studied why is it 60 grams per hour? Because I can ingest much more than that. And it turned out that the limitation is the uptake in the intestine. So this is why we developed this carbohydrate mixture that uses different transporters in the intestine and actually allows much greater uptake. And we've seen uptakes well, far over 90 wow. grams per hour. Wow. But we generally recommend that 90 grams per hour is what athletes should aim for in very long distance events. Now, if you do that with those same people, they all increase their carbohydrate uptake by about the same percentage. So it's the physiology in some ways is very similar between people.
Wow. You wouldn't even think it. I mean, and I look at female athletes as well. When you've got someone like Danny Reef compared to someone like Lucy Charles, who's a lot smaller, and then Danny Reef, who's a larger athlete, again, more muscular athlete. But you're saying that the obviously there would be those finer differences, but that the nutritional differences shouldn't be that different.
Yeah, correct. I would give them fairly similar advice, yep. But the advice would be more dependent on sort of what is their habitual, like regular yep. carbohydrate
okay.
intake.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what about when it comes to, because obviously, again, we talk about the hotter races. And the reason I talk about the hotter races is because that seems to be when issues with nutrition are exacerbated, cramping, people not being able to ingest calories because they just bring them back up. But cramping is obviously a huge thing. And I do a lot of, I cover a lot of races in the Asia Pacific region where it is often excruciatingly hot and humid. And I see a lot of cramping. And it brings me to one athlete in particular, and he's a tiny athlete, Tim Reed, and I've had a lot of discussions with Tim, and he's done a lot of testing where he does, like we were talking before about losing a lot of salt. So apparently his salt loss is almost double what another of his a fellow athlete might be. So he really struggles with cramping when it comes to hotter races, and he's had to obviously change his nutrition plan to try and cope with that. So is that something that this platform takes into consideration too, with salt loss?
Yeah, at the moment, no. But also because the research just isn't strong enough. So I don't think it is the right conclusion to say, someone is cramping, so it must be electrolytes
or lack of salt or magnesium.
Exactly. And we often jump to those conclusions, but there's actually very little evidence in the literature that it is related to that. This doesn't mean that it cannot be related to it, but I don't think we can generalize that. Oh, it must be electrolytes. It's I think we understand still very little about what causes cramp.
Yeah.
And even less about how can we prevent it, because otherwise everyone would be using it and no one would be having
it. No, that's right.
Anymore.
And I'd love to hear your take on, obviously people have said in the past that it's always the bigger athlete. So, Lionel Sanders suffering cramps in Kona, it's because he's a big athlete. But that's not necessarily the truth, because I know talking to many athletes who are bigger, musclier athletes, and they've never suffered a cramp in their life. So, and then you've got someone like Tim Reed, who's lucky to be 60 kilos wringing wet, and here he is suffering cramps a lot. So it's not a certain physique that's going to suffer cramps more than another necessarily.
Not necessarily, no. I think larger athletes in general will struggle with the heat a little bit more than smaller
okay.
athletes. That is true, and maybe for that reason, like cramping will also happen a little bit earlier, but that doesn't mean they cannot happen in the
smaller athletes.
Smaller
yeah,
athletes.
Yeah. Oh, honestly, it's funny because I kicked myself because I know when I was young racing and like you said, I spent all this time and energy on getting a good coach and training and sticking to that program like glue, and nutrition just seemed to be something that you're just worried about it maybe a week leading into the race and then on race day itself. And I think now with all the information that's out there, it would be, I wish I could do it all again, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it'll just continue to improve. And I think the main thing that stands in the way for people is the amount of misinformation
yeah, yeah.
that also grows or grows even more than the good information.
Yeah.
So I wish we had better ways to help people to decide what is good and what is bad information.
No, I totally agree. And again, I just see the difference in some of the athletes here. But a little bit, because I had a couple of athletes that asked, and these are professional athletes, you know, that do enjoy having a glass or two of red wine. Not every night, but, you know, every now and again. Is that a bad thing? And maybe I'm asking this for myself, let's be honest.
No, I think I believe very much in moderation. I don't believe in bad foods, good foods. So I think yes, there definitely is there is room for a glass now and then. It's just in moderation, and like thinking about the castle that we started with. I don't think the glass of red wine is really gonna like add much to the castle, but the question is, occasionally a glass, is that gonna
break down the castle? Yep. So it's all about
it probably
all
isn't.
About when and when and where.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Asker, obviously Fuel the Core, so Core Nutrition Planning is one of the major sponsors for Challenge Family. Can you just let me know how did that relationship come about to begin with? I mean, obviously I know Power Bar is also one of our biggest sponsors as well for Challenge Family, and then Core Nutrition Planning. So how did that come about, and why did you decide that would be a good relationship?
Yeah, it was mostly through my relationship with CB from Challenge, and so we I thought that this platform could actually be something that sort of adds value to athletes, and then if we build in all of the challenge races into the software, and you can easily find your challenge race, that also means that immediately we know the software knows what is available on course in terms of products. It also knows where the feed stations are. The software also knows what the weather conditions are on the day. So you can really start to do some great planning with this tool. And so it was really from the point of just adding a little something that Challenge can offer to athletes that participate in their races, and that's how this was born.
You know what? I've worked for Challenge Family for many years, and I did not know that's how precise it was. That's awesome. Oh.
Yeah, we have to improve how we talk about this, because I think it can actually help a lot of people for sure.
So, for example, let's take our biggest race, Challenge Roth, in July, obviously in the middle of summer in Germany. Of course, it's Europe, so you can get a mixed bag. I mean, I've been to that race I think 15 times, and it's you know, we've had days where it's been 40 degrees and people have been melting. But then we've had the odd occasion when it's 12 degrees and people have been freezing. But obviously with your platform, it will know that it's a race that's in the middle of summer in Europe. So these are the conditions that you could have, and it builds a program based around the actual course plus the weather conditions, and can actually tell you exactly where you will be able to get fuel from. So the aid stations on course.
Yeah, exactly. And then it will also tell you like the total plan. It'll tell you need this many gels, this many drinks from the aid stations, and this is what you need to bring yourself. So it spells that out as well.
It's a no-brainer. Why didn't you have this when I was back racing? Oh, my God. It would have taken all the guesswork out of it. That's incredible.
Yes, I think people should just try it and see. Well, first of all, see how the plan that Core produces, how it compares to what they would normally do. And like a lot of people would get aha moments. It's like, and they would probably see, maybe I just took way too much or maybe I took way too little. And
And can you just repeat for our listeners, if they wanted to do that week free trial, what's the website?
Yeah, the website is www.fuelthecore.com.
Perfect.
And it is more than a week free trial. It's just free. if you don't have all of the ways to personalize. So there is just a version. So if you just want to try it, there is a version to try.
And then, of course, if you like it, then you can obviously go into the more premium where more questions are asked, so you can get a more specific.
Absolutely. Yeah,
okay, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Oh, I could have you on here all night asking you questions. I have so many of my own questions to ask about nutrition. It's just, it's one of those topics that's ever evolving. I mean, you must have seen so many changes over the years from when you very first started looking into nutrition to where we are right now.
Yeah, absolutely. When I started working in professional cycling, for example, it was still the thought that the bigger the ride or the bigger the stage, the bigger the steak there had to be at breakfast.
Oh, no way.
And things, yes, and things have just moved on quite a lot since.
So that's not necessarily the case. So if you've got a stage where you know that the rider is going to be out there for 7 hours, that doesn't mean bigger fueling necessarily in the morning.
No, I just generally mean bigger fueling, just not in the form of a steak.
Okay, yeah, of course.
Yeah, but yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. Okay, well, I think we're going to have to get you on again, because I know that after this podcast, I'm going to have loads of questions. So for all of you athletes out there that have listened, that are going to listen to this podcast or are listening, if you have any specific nutrition questions to ask Asuka, please let me know. By just returning the questions to our either Instagram or to Twitter for Challenge Family, because I would love an excuse to get Asuka back online again, to hit him up on all the specific questions that you guys may have. And I know you've got plenty. I could actually get him online just to ask my questions alone, but I won't be so selfish. So I'll wait till I get a few from all the other athletes out there. But Asuka, thank you so much. I don't know if I'm going to feel too guilty to go downstairs and have my glass of wine tonight or not. But you know, we'll see if I've earned it.
Phil, yeah, you should.
I should.
You should. But it was an absolute pleasure, Belinda, and very happy to do this again.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. I know you're just starting the day, whereas my day is coming to an end over here in Australia. So I hope you have a wonderful day, and thanks again, Asuka. You've been wonderful.
Thank you. Speak to you soon.
Sure. Thanks for listening to Coffee Calls with Belinda. I really hope you enjoyed listening. If you'd like to continue listening and stay updated on our latest podcasts, then please subscribe. It would also be great if you could rate our podcast and leave us a review. If you have any specific questions you'd like me to ask the athletes, then please send through to the following email address, podcast@challenge-family.com. The making of these podcasts would not be possible without the wonderful help of our great partners, Powerbar, Otso, Zone 3, Lubos Bilic at LB Training, Sport No Limit Group, and VeloSoc. But for now, thanks so much for listening, and I'll be back soon for another coffee.